I was sitting at my desk earlier today, just totally zoning out and messing around with a paperclip. You know how you do, you bend it out of shape, twist it, maybe bend it back and forth a few times?
Ah, yes, the universal sign of a deeply boring meeting. We have all been there.
Exactly. And inevitably it gets hot and then snap, it breaks. But as I was looking at those jagged little metal edges, I started thinking about what you always say on this show.
That we tend to just look at the object and ignore the architecture hidden inside it.
Right, because we look at that steel and we just think, okay, it broke because it's metal, it's hard, it snaps. We assume those properties are just the soul of the material, like that's just its personality.
That is definitely the intuitive view. But it's really not about the soul of the metal at all. It's about a highly complex game of geometry happening at a scale we can't even see.
And it really is a game, right? Like a microscopic high-stakes game of connect the dots at the atomic level. If the dots connect in one pattern, you get a bridge that holds up a massive freight train.
Yes, and if they connect in a slightly different pattern, I mean, even just a tiny angular shift, that same bridge could literally crumble into the river.
Which is exactly the kind of terrified thrill I come here for. So, welcome back to the deep dive, everyone. Today, we are tackling an absolute beast of a topic. We're unpacking chapter three of HKDH Padatia's Geometry of Crystals.
Geometry of crystals. I know that title sounds like something you see on a syllabus and immediately try to drop the class.
It sounds so dry, I totally admit it. When I first saw the source material, I thought, oh boy, here we go. But once you actually get into it, you realize this isn't just about drawing shapes on graph paper.
Not at all. It is about the hidden scaffolding of reality.
And specifically, our mission for this deep dive is to leave the safety of the textbook. Because when we learn science in school or even intro engineering, we usually stick to the cubic world, right?
Right, the idealized geometry. Think of a cube of table salt. Everything is square. Everything is 90 degrees. It is safe and it's highly predictable.
I call it the cubic comfort zone.
That's a good name for it. But nature hates a vacuum, and honestly, it also gets bored with perfect cubes. Most of the really interesting materials, the actual stuff we build our civilization out of, they live in a low symmetry Wild West.
The messy stuff. We're talking hexagonal structures and orthorhombic structures.
Exactly. And the goal today is to figure out how the math completely changes when we leave the perfect symmetry of the cube.
And the part that actually blew my mind, which we will get to, is how those shifting mathematical rules are quite literally the only reason we have a modern civilization.
It sounds like pure hyperbole.
Yeah.
I know, but by the end of this deep dive, I think you will agree, it is the literal foundation of the Iron Age.
Okay, so let's establish the baseline before we break it. Why do scientists and engineers love cubes so much? Like, what makes the cubic comfort zone so comfortable in the first place?
It comes down to navigation and labeling. Imagine you are standing in a city where all the streets form a perfect grid. Think of Manhattan, but mathematically flawless. North, south, east, west.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
If you look at your map and the map says go north, you just look at the street sign that says north and they point in the exact same direction.
Yeah.
The map matches the territory perfectly.
Right, it's totally intuitive.
Now, in crystallography, we use indices, basically sets of numbers, to label planes, which are flat surfaces like the face of a crystal. And we also use them to label directions, which are just arrows pointing through space.
Okay, planes are flat surfaces, directions are arrows. Got it.
In that cubic world, if you have a plane labeled 1, 2, 3, the arrow pointing exactly perpendicular to it, what we call the normal, is also labeled 1, 2, 3.
So the numbers just match. The North Street leads to the North destination.
Exactly. The direction vector is parallel to the plane normal when the numbers are identical. It's a mathematically elegant system. You do not even have to think about it.
But then chapter three happens, and we leave the grid city.
We enter the orthorhombic or hexagonal systems. Now imagine that same grid city, but suddenly the blocks are not square anymore. Maybe the east-west blocks are stretched out so they are twice as long as the north-south blocks.
Or they intersect at weird angles, right? Like 120 degrees instead of 90.
Precisely. So now if you look at your map and it says go north, the actual street pointing north might be veering off to the left.
The rule just completely breaks down. The text actually uses this really great visual figure 3.1, I think. It shows a 2D rectangle where side B is much longer than side A.
Yes. And if you draw a diagonal direction through that rectangle, let's call it direction 1, 1, and then you draw the plane labeled 1, 1, 1.
They don't line up at all.
Not even close. The direction arrow is pointing off into space nowhere near perpendicular to the plane.
So if I'm an engineer and I assume those old cubic rules still apply, I'm going to be calculating forces in completely the wrong direction.
You would be designing a structure destined to fail. And this distortion gets even trippier when we try to draw maps of these crystals, which we call stereograms.
Right, let's unpack stereograms for a second, because the source material relies on them heavily. I always picture them like those old naval radar screens, a big circle with a bunch of dots plotted on it.
That is a very solid way to visualize it. It is essentially a globe of the crystal projected onto a flat piece of paper.
Yeah.
And the dots are the poles. Think of them as the north poles of the different crystal faces.
Now, in the cubic comfort zone, because everything is a perfect square, those dots are always in the exact same place relative to each other, right? Like a corner is always a corner. 90 degrees is always 90 degrees, no matter how big the cube is.
Correct. The angular relationships are fixed by the pure symmetry of the cube. But in the low symmetry world, the position of those dots depends entirely on the lattice parameters.
Lattice parameters, that's just the physical length of the sides of the crystal, right?
Length of the sides and the angles between them. The text gives a really striking comparison. It shows a stereogram for a cubic lattice, where the parameter is just 5 units for every side.
Okay.
Then it puts it right next to an orthorhombic lattice, where the sides are 2, 3, and 8 units.
And I remember looking at that diagram, they look nothing alike. The cubic one is beautifully symmetrical, it looks like a kaleidoscope, but the orthorhombic one looks totally squashed.
It's severely distorted. The symmetry is lost. Those fourfold rotation points that make the cube look so nice just vanish entirely.
But here's what I don't totally get. Does it really matter? Like, if the map looks a little squashed, can't we just read it the same way and adjust our math?
No, because the dots actually move. Think of it like drawing a face on a balloon.
Yeah.
If the balloon is a perfect sphere, the eyes are a certain fixed distance apart. But if I pull on that balloon and stretch it into an oval,
The eyes physically move away from each other.
exactly. If you change just one of those lattice parameters, say you swap an 8 for a 5, the dots on your stereogram map fundamentally shift position.
That is wild. In a cube, the geometry is completely static, but in these materials, the geometry is dynamic based on the specific atoms you're using. It feels like trying to build a house on a foundation that keeps changing its shape.
It is exactly that frustrating. And honestly, if you think the orthorhombic system is tricky, that is really just the appetizer. The main course of frustration in crystallography is the hexagonal system.
Oh, yes, a hexagonal headache. Reading that section, I could almost feel the author's pain. It seemed like they were genuinely angry at the math itself.
It presents a very unique challenge. Picture a honeycomb. That is your basic structure.
Okay, honeycomb. Six-sided cells, like a stack of Pringles cans.
Right. So geometrically, you have two sides of equal length. Let's call them A and B. And they sit at exactly 120 degrees to each other. Then you have a third side C, which is usually the height of the prism and is a totally different length.
Sounds simple enough so far.
Visually, yes.
Yeah.
Mathematically, it's a nightmare. Here is the core problem. In this honeycomb structure, think about the outer walls. The wall facing you, the wall to your left, the wall to your right. Physically, they are identical.
Right. If I close my eyes and you spun the honeycomb around, I wouldn't be able to tell which wall was which. They're totally equivalent.
They are part of the exact same form. So you would naturally expect their names, their indices to look related, right? Like variations on a theme. 1, 2, 3, 2, 1, 3, 3, 2, 1.
Sure, that's how it works in the cubic system. The numbers just swap places and you instantly know they belong to the same family.
But in the standard three-index system for hexagons, the indices for these identical physical walls are 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, and 1, 0, 1, 0.
Wait, 100 and 010 look related. They both have a 1 and 2 zeros, but 110 looks like a completely different animal.
Exactly. It completely breaks the visual pattern. It hides the underlying symmetry.
It's like having three identical triplets and naming them Bob, Larry, and Steve.
Steve is definitely the outlier in that family.
You completely lose the family resemblance. So if you're a scientist and you're staring at a data set with thousands of measurements and the labels don't look alike, you might completely miss a crucial structural pattern.
You would absolutely miss it. So to fix this, they introduce a fourth wheel, or rather a fourth index. This is called the Miller-Bravais system.
Okay, the Miller-Bravais system.
Instead of three numbers, HKL, they use four, HKIL.
Okay, and where does this magical eye come from? Did they just pick a random number to make it look pretty?
No, it is rigidly calculated from the first two. The rule is I equals negative H plus K.
Okay, let me do some mental math here. So if my plane is 100, 1 plus 0 is 1. Make it negative, so I is negative 1. So the whole thing becomes 10, negative 10.
Spot on. And 010 becomes 01-10.
And what about our weird Steve triplet, the 110?
Well, 1 + 1 = 2, so I is -2. Wait, actually, the text uses a different set of equivalent planes to illustrate this perfectly. Let's look at the prism planes.
Okay, hit me.
When you work out the full notation for the complete set of equivalent planes in this four-index system, it aligns beautifully so that they all use the exact same digits. Usually combinations of 1s, 0s, and -1s just shuffled around.
So Bob, Larry, and Steve basically become trip 1, trip 2, and trip 3.
Exactly. It restores the mathematical elegance. When you look at the numbers, the symmetry is instantly obvious again.
I do love elegance, but I feel like there is always a catch in this text. You don't just get a free extra number without some kind of consequence, right?
There is a massive mathematical tax for this elegance. The text makes a very big point of this. While the Miller-Bravais system makes planes look nice converting directions, the vectors into this four-index system is just awful.
How awful are we talking? Like basic algebra awful or calculus awful?
It's conceptually awful because you can't just add the numbers simply anymore. You have to ensure that a geometric rule called the Weisson law is satisfied.
The Weisson law? That sounds like some kind of restrictive sci-fi treaty. Do not cross into the Weisson.
It does sound intimidating.
Yeah.
It is basically a rule that says a direction lying in a specific plane must be perfectly perpendicular to that plane's normal.
Makes sense.
In the standard three-index system, checking this is very easy math, just a quick dot product. But to keep that physical rule true, while forcing four numbers into the mix, you have to use complex conversion formulas.
What kind of formulas? Give me an example.
Messy ones involving fractions, like big U equals 1/3 × 2 little u minus little v. You are suddenly dealing with fractions and factors of a third just to write down the coordinates of a single arrow.
Ugh, fractions. So you are basically trading really simple calculation math for aesthetically pleasing labels.
That is the exact trade-off. And the text poses a fascinating philosophical question about this. Is it worth it? Is the intellectual cost of doing all this extra fractional math worth the elegance of the notation?
That is the ultimate scientist dilemma right there. Do I want my data to look perfectly symmetrical for the journal publication, or do I want it to be easy enough to calculate on a napkin at the bar?
The source leaves it entirely as a matter of taste. Some scientists strongly prefer the raw, ugly three-index system because calculation is fast and efficient. Others swear by the four-index system because capturing the true symmetry is paramount to them.
I think I am team aesthetics on this one. If I'm studying the fundamental laws of the universe, I kind of want them to look symmetrical.
Many agree with you.
But okay, we have talked about broken maps and notation wars and hexagonal headaches. I want to get to the real so what of this deep dive.
The stakes.
Yes, the stakes. Why does any of this abstract geometry matter to someone building a suspension bridge or a car engine or a literal frying pan? Why should you care if your atoms are in a hexagon or a cube?
This is exactly where we crash land from abstract math into real-world life-or-death engineering. We need to talk about ductility.
Ductility, which is basically how much a metal can stretch or bend or deform without snapping in half.
Correct. Now, here is a physical reality we often forget. Most of the metals we use every single day are polycrystalline.
Meaning what exactly?
There are not one giant, perfect, continuous crystal like a gemstone. They are made up of millions of tiny, microscopic crystal grains all jammed and stuck together.
Like a complicated 3D mosaic.
Yes, a mosaic. Now imagine you take that metal mosaic and you squeeze it in a press. You apply massive stress. For the piece of metal to actually change shape to bend instead of shattering, those individual microscopic grains have to change their own shape.
Okay, that makes intuitive sense.
But they're super glued to their neighbors. A grain in the middle can't just stretch out to the left if the neighbor to its left isn't also moving to make room. They have to perfectly coordinate their deformation.
It's like being on a really crowded dance floor. If I want to bust out a wild move, I need everyone around me to shift out of the way, or I am just going to elbow someone right in the face.
That is a perfect analogy. And mathematically, to accommodate an arbitrary change in shape in 3D space without ripping apart from your neighbors, a crystal needs a very specific amount of structural freedom.
And this is where the connect the dots game comes back into play.
It is. The text cites something called the von Mises criterion. It dictates that to remain entirely intact while deforming a crystal grain must possess 5 independent slip systems.
5. That is the magic survival number.
Think of a slip system as a specific traffic lane inside the crystal where planes of atoms can safely slide past each other. If you have 5 independent lanes, the grains can twist and stretch and squash in enough different ways to stay connected to their neighbors.
So the metal bends, it's ductile.
Exactly.
And what happens if you have fewer than 5 lanes?
Traffic jam. The atoms literally cannot move where they need to go. Massive internal stress builds up at the boundaries. And since the grains can't change shape to relieve the stress, they separate.
They pull apart. Cracks form. Fracture. The material is fundamentally brittle.
And this brings us right back to our hexagonal headache.
Uh-oh. I have a bad feeling the hexagon is not going to pass this von Mises test.
Hexagonal metals often have a massive structural problem. Because of that highly layered honeycomb shape, they generally only like to slip on one specific geometric plane, the basal plane. Think of it as the flat top and bottom of the honeycomb cell.
Okay, so they can slide horizontally pretty easily, like pushing a deck of cards across a table.
Ideally, yes. But slipping on just that one basal plane only provides 3 independent slip systems.
And last time I checked, 3 is significantly less than 5.
Precisely. Because 3 is less than 5 when you apply severe stress to a standard polycrystalline hexagonal metal. The grains simply cannot mathematically accommodate the shape change. They fracture.
So geometry is quite literally destiny. Because of the atomic shape of the crystal, the metal physically cannot bend enough to survive the real world.
In many cases, yes, that is the harsh reality. But nature is incredibly clever. The text gives us a fascinating counterexample to this rule, an iron manganese alloy.
Okay.
It has a hexagonal structure, yet it is surprisingly ductile.
Wait, how does it cheat the von Mises system if it's hexagonal?
It finds more traffic lanes. It doesn't just limit itself to slipping on that flat basal plane. Under stress, it activates slip on the prism planes, which are the vertical walls of the honeycomb, and the pyramidal planes, which are the diagonals.
Oh, wow.
By utilizing all these different geometric faces simultaneously, it scrapes together just enough independent slip systems to pass that 5-system test.
That is surprisingly resourceful for a piece of cold metal. It's like finding a brilliant loophole in the structural tax code. But this actually leads us perfectly to the absolute highlight of this source material, the genuine mind-blowing moment. We need to talk about iron.
We do. Iron, the undisputed backbone of human industry.
We use it for literally everything. Bridges, skyscrapers, cargo ships, car frames. And we relied on it because it's incredibly tough, but It yields, it bends. It doesn't just shatter like glass when you hit a pothole on the highway.
Right. At room temperature, iron has a body-centered cubic structure. It lives right in the heart of the cubic comfort zone. And because it is perfectly cubic, it has a massive amount of symmetry options. It boasts 12 independent slip systems.
12. That is way more than the required 5. It's an overachiever.
Which is exactly why iron is so incredibly workable. You can hammer it, hot roll it, draw it into thin wire. It is a deeply forgiving material. But here is the massive bombshell from the text. Iron's cubic structure is actually an anomaly.
An anomaly? What do you mean it's an anomaly?
Look at the periodic table.
Yeah.
Look at iron's direct cousins, the elements positioned right below it, ruthenium and osmium. They have the exact same outer electron structure as iron. By all physical rights, they should crystallize into the exact same shape.
And what shape are ruthenium and osmium?
They are hexagonal.
Oh.
And because they are hexagonal, they are terribly brittle. We do not build massive suspension bridges out of osmium. If we did the very first time a heavy semi-truck drove over it, crack. The whole thing comes down.
So why is iron different? Why is iron the special chosen child of the periodic table that gets to be a comfortable cube and basically save human engineering?
Magnetism, specifically ferromagnetism. The source explicitly states that the cubic form of iron is actually mechanically unstable on its own, but it is stabilized by its magnetic properties.
Wait, hold on. So the magnetism is literally holding the iron atoms in that cubic arrangement, like an invisible scaffolding.
That is exactly what the physics implies. If you somehow took away the ferromagnetism, iron would instantly revert to what the text calls its stable form, which would be hexagonal.
And if it were hexagonal?
It would likely adopt a motif of paired atoms, and its easy slip system would be strictly limited to that basal plane we talked about earlier. It would possess fewer than 5 independent slip systems.
Meaning it would be brittle.
Meaning if you hit an iron I-beam with a heavy sledgehammer, it might just snap in two.
This is the part where I actually had to put the text down and just stare at the wall for a second. The author's actually right, and I want to quote this exactly because it's so profound. So in the absence of ferromagnetism, we would not have civilization in the form that we know today.
It is a staggering statement, but it's true. Think about it. Our entire ability to forge complex tools, to build structures that can withstand wind shear and massive weight, the entire industrial revolution. Steam engines, rail networks, it all hinges on the bizarre cosmic coincidence that iron happens to be magnetic.
Which forces it into a cubic geometry, which then allows it to slip in 12 directions instead of 3.
Talk about the ultimate butterfly effect.
Right.
One invisible quantum property changes the geometric shape, which drastically changes the material properties, which literally dictates the course of human history.
It connects the invisible microworld to our macro reality in the most dramatic way possible. I am honestly never going to look at a cast iron frying pan the same way again. It is only a pan because it's magnetic.
Otherwise, it would just be a useless pile of metallic shards on your stove.
Okay, I am still slightly reeling from the whole no civilization without magnetism thing, but we have one more really fascinating case study in the text that proves why scientists absolutely need this complex 3D math. It's about a material called cementite.
Ah, yes, cementite. F3C. It is a very hard, very brittle compound that often precipitates inside steel alloys. And it frequently forms these structures called laths.
Laths are like, they're basically long, thin, rectangular strips, right? Kind of like a microscopic tongue depressor.
Correct. Now, metallurgists wanted to answer a seemingly basic question. In which crystallographic direction does this lath grow the fastest? It sounds like a very simple observational task.
Right. I mean, you just look at it under an electron microscope, find the longest side and measure it. Done and dusted.
But here's the geometric trap. When you look through that microscope, you're looking at a 2D slice of a complex 3D object. The text explicitly warns that what looks like the longest axis on a random 2D slice is very often not the true growth direction. It is an optical illusion based on perspective.
Oh, I get it. It's like if I take a carrot and I slice it at a really sharp angle, I get this long, stretched out oval shape. But that oval doesn't actually tell me which way the carrot was pointing when it was growing in the ground.
Exactly. So to find the truth, they had to use a technique called trace analysis. They didn't just look at the raw 2D shape. They meticulously plotted the directions of the physical edges, the traces, on a stereogram.
So we are back to the maps.
We are back to the maps. And because cementite is orthorhombic, remember that heavily squashed, low symmetry system, they had to use all the really difficult broken symmetry math. They plotted complex traces like 011, 012, and 013.
And what did this complex map finally tell them?
When they plotted these directional traces from many different angled samples, they found that the lines all perfectly intersected at one specific unique point on the stereogram map, the 100 direction.
Which corresponds to the physical A axis of the crystal.
Yes. This definitively proved, mathematically rather than visually, that cementite grows fastest along the 100 direction.
I love this example so much because it proves that your own eyes can lie to you. A million-dollar microscope can lie to you, but the geometry, the pure 3D geometry, always tells the truth.
That really is the recurring theme of Chapter 3. Whether you are trying to predict if a bridge will snap or determining how a microscopic crystal grows, you simply cannot ignore the rigorous 3D geometry. The simple 2D view or the lazy cubic assumption will constantly lead you astray.
It is a stark reminder that the physical world is so much more complex and vastly more interesting than a simple high school textbook cube.
And actually, before we completely wrap up, there is one final thought the text leaves us with that I think you'll appreciate. It's a bit of a curveball regarding everything we just discussed. We have been talking this whole time about iron being perfectly cubic because of its ferromagnetism, right?
Right. The civilization saver, the magnetic scaffolding that keeps us out of the Stone Age.
Well, strictly speaking, it isn't actually perfectly cubic.
Oh, no. Please do not take this away from me. We just firmly established that all of modern human civilization depends on it being a cube.
Do not panic. It is still highly ductile. But the text notes a fascinating detail. Below a certain temperature, the magnetic spins of the iron atoms tend to strongly align along one specific crystallographic axis. And this alignment actually distorts the perfect cube ever so slightly into a tetragonal shape.
So it actually stretches out a tiny bit in one direction.
A very microscopic amount, yes. But it is physically real. It is a phenomenon known as the magnetostrictive effect. It literally means the physical dimensions of the solid material change when you subject it to a magnetic field.
That is wild. It implies that our seemingly solid reality, these hard, immovable metals we build our world out of, are actually constantly shifting and breathing in response to totally invisible forces.
It absolutely does. It suggests that solid is a highly relative term. The internal geometry is dynamic, it responds, it shifts.
Well, on that somewhat unsettling note, heavily questioning the solid reality of the floor beneath my feet, we should probably wrap this up.
Probably for the best before we spiral all the way down into full quantum mechanics.
Fair enough. We have gone from completely broken maps to hexagonal headaches, all the way to the magnetic anomaly that lets us build skyscrapers. It turns out looking at a simple paperclip really can be a profound experience if you understand the math inside it.
It really is the hidden blueprint of the universe just sitting right there in your desk drawer.
Thanks so much for helping us decode it today. And thank you to everyone out there listening to this deep dive. The next time you pick up any piece of metal, just remember you are holding a little structural miracle of symmetry. Stay curious, everyone.